You are now listening to What's the Fuzz? A furry podcast that advocates for diversity, equality, and cultural exchange inside and outside of the fandom. Never miss another episode again. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And now, your host, Reiner.
Hey Fuzzles, what's up? It's your host Reiner coming at you to give you a boop on the snoot. Thanks super much for tuning in, I'm happy to see ya. This episode was originally recorded on February 18th, 2021, and should be published around March 28th, 2021. Shout out to Bad Will and Captain Nico for the dope-ass new intro and outro music. We're using a song of his called Glitter. If you want to help Bad Will out, you can check him out over on Twitter and check out his song on Fur Affinity, both of which I'll be linking below. Trust me. If you're into R&B, hip-hop, or jazzy flavors, he's got you covered. I also want to give a shout-out to Tea Cakes for drawing the new podcast cover artwork. I love it! She did such an incredible job, and I'll be linking her Twitter down below. Guys, don't forget we have so much talent in the furry fandom, especially when it comes to BIPOC artists and musicians that need your support. Anyway, today I'm sitting down with Serb, a phenomenal artist with an eye for color that's hard to surpass. Be sure to check him out over on Twitter at C_Burris, and I'll be linking her other projects in the show notes below. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Serb. I can't wait to find out more about you and what matters to you.
Yeah, Chris. Wow, that was so flattering. Thanks.
Yeah, hey, I gotta be honest. I am a fan. Just like when I saw those art pieces, I was just like, damn, those are some colors. So yeah, I'm gonna throw an iceberg question at you. You ready for it?
Sure.
What is the one place you'd love to see before the world ends?
Oh man, there's a lot of places I want to go. I really do want to travel a lot when I have the means, and once the hell times are over. I've always wanted to go see. Japan is kind of a typical answer, isn't it?
Yeah, but just, Japan's pretty, so it's fine.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, someplace like in Europe or Japan or something like that.
We're specifically in Japan, though. What prefecture?
Probably somewhere in the countryside. I think it would be really cool to see another places like... Like a really different ecosystem than the ones we have here would be really cool.
You just roll up on some quiet townsfolk, be like, hey, what's up?
Yeah, pretty much.
Awesome, awesome. Now let's get down to the actual questions. To get started here, the listeners would like to know a little bit more about you. So where you're from, how old you are, your pronouns, your ethnicity, and how you would describe your sexuality/gender identity if you feel inclined to say so.
Sure. So I can do a little introduction in Smalgach, which is the traditional, it's the language of my nation, Tsimshian. So, Serb Diwayu, Tsimshianu, Gisbetwara di Tegu, British Columbia, Canada, Diwil Watgu, at a Phoenix Diwil Zoku, Notsnu, at a Miutanu. So what I said was, my name is Serb, I'm Tsimshian, Gisbetwara, or Killer Whale, is my clan, and I was born in British Columbia, Canada. To be more specific, it was on Tanaha land in Southeast British Columbia, and I live right now in Phoenix, which is Akimau Ootam in Peeposh land, and I am two-spirit. I am a lesbian, and I am non-binary.
Ooh, that was a cool introduction.
Jewish. Yeah.
And you're Jewish?
I am.
Damn. That's some crazy... That is cool as hell. So what's your main OC and how do you feel you express yourself through them?
Patish is my fursona, and she is... I really like designing hybrids and thinking about like how different animal features would go together in a cool way. And so Patiche is a dragon, a killer whale, and a tiger. And it was kind of important to me to have a fursona, because I've kind of experimented with just like wolves or like things like that in the past. But I like having something that's a little extra and has a lot of different features, because it's like, I'm kind of, you know, I'm two spirit, and I'm a lesbian, but also like I'm non-binary, which makes it a little more complicated. And like I'm Tsimshian, but I'm also like I'm Jewish, and I'm also Scottish. So it's like I'm kind of cut between all these different worlds. So it's important to me to have that reflected in my fursona in kind of a more exaggerated physical way.
Hell yeah. You're like an amalgamation of all these cool ass things.
Thanks.
And what brought you to the furry fandom in the first place?
I don't really remember if there was something specific. It's been kind of on and off my whole life. I grew up on the internet, obviously. So mm-hmm. I've always known about furries, and I was always like, man, like, it'd be cool to be a furry, but I don't know. I didn't really start associating with the fandom super strongly until I really started taking art seriously as a career or a profession, like a couple years back, basically. So
you thought it would be cool to be a furry. You wouldn't want to dunk on them or anything?
No. Well, you know, well, like, I always had my thought process was always, I had the capacity to be one. Like, I experimented with fursonas and stuff. I just never, like, I never got on, like, Fur Affinity and, like, made a bunch of furry friends and stuff like that. So I didn't really consider myself part of the fandom, but.
True. You could have been one of those proto dog kids that ran around all fours and, like, barked at the other kids.
I did do that with warrior cats. I role-played warrior cats when I was a kid.
I knew it. I knew it had to come from somewhere. It doesn't just like appear one day.
Okay, maybe the warrior cats was where it started. You got me.
Yeah, it seems so. I've been seeing nonstop warrior cats like fan art and like animations and relatable TikToks about how people used to role play as warrior cats. So, yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Second wave cat fandom.
Yeah.
So you've been part of it for like your entire life, basically. Have you noticed a lot of changes in it over time?
Mostly, I guess, because I was mostly an outsider at the beginning. I didn't have a great pulse on it, but I mean, like, especially over like the last couple years, it's certainly, this is something I hear people talk about on past episodes of your podcast too. Like, it's woken up a lot to not just like, you know, to not just being purely about LGBT stuff. It's also including like furs of color more now, which is cool. It should have happened a lot earlier, but like, it has opened up a lot more and become a lot more conscious of racism in the last little while, I think is the biggest change.
Yeah, I think us, like, as a people, moving past the whole color blindness thing has helped a lot, because if you were to acknowledge that someone was, like, the whole King Cougar thing, like, he came up with fursonas, right, and he's black. If... It would be kind of weird, I think, back then to acknowledge someone as, you know, being black and being the person to create fursonas, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I think things are better now because of, like, Black Lives Matter and things like that. That we can draw attention to things without it being, like, inherently negative.
Yeah.
Has being part of the fandom changed your life in any meaningful way?
Since I only really got serious about it from an art standpoint in the last year or so, it's mostly from, I think, like an opportunity perspective. Like, having my art like recognized and like being able to make money off of it from commissions is like in a way that I wouldn't be able to in any other space is really incredible. And also in a more, in less of a community sense, it is really like just being able to express yourself with like a fursona and everything is really, it's really cool. And it's definitely something that has helped me, like learn to express myself for sure.
But yeah, I think it's really cool that, furry art can present itself in such a way. Like, I feel like people don't usually get commissioned to draw things that are just of their own manifest, unless it's like fan art or something. So having it be like someone's persona is like, ooh, it's fun.
Yeah, for sure.
So then your interactions are more so online than offline, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not about to sell all your belongings and just live off of convention to convention or something like that.
Yeah, no. I mean, even before COVID, I don't really have the means to travel very much. So I've never been to a con, actually. I'd like to go to one for sure, but it's I grew up in like semi-rural Canada, so I didn't really have a way to go to one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, the closest FurCon to where I would have been as a kid is, like, Vancouver, which is, like, it's obscenely far for driving.
So it's more like an accessibility issue rather than you not wanting to go, then?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Damn. I wonder if there's anything we could do to change that in the future. Cons aren't, like, easy to fund or anything.
It would be cool to see like cons, I don't know, like kind of making room to have some like lottery tickets or something like that. I don't know, but something you apply for if you can't afford to go.
Like Willy Wonka golden tickets. You've been selected. Okay. You can go to the FurCon.
Well, maybe not when you put it like that. I changed my mind.
I mean, I don't see why not. We could have it be like little keychains that's like a foxtail or something, and it could be like this whole thing that we do.
Aw, that would be cute.
It would be. So do you often find yourself telling people that you're a furry?
Not really. Well, all of the people I've been friends with already know.
Damn, you're ahead of the game.
I mean, especially lately, I don't meet people in person, really. So, like, it's online, and online I'm very obvious about being a furry. Like, it's on my Twitter, my fursona is my Discord icon. Like, pretty much all of my existing friends already know.
That's true. I feel you there.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about being BIPOC and part of the furry fandom that sets us apart from everyone else?
I really enjoy like bringing the unique parts of my heritage to my art for sure. Like there's a uniqueness you get when you can bring like cultural art forms to the fandom that you've never really seen before. I really enjoy like having new takes on furry that way and seeing other Black Indigenous people of color doing the same.
Hell yeah, like Wolf's art is super unique and I don't see it anywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I definitely see a similar thing when it comes to your art. It's like your own personal imprint. I really like that.
Thank you, yeah.
Since you want to talk about your, like, disabilities and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the struggles you deal with because of your disability people should understand?
Well, a lot of it is just, like, the judgment and the non-understanding. Like, the disabilities I have are invisible. and they're some of them are kind of rare, and people don't, and they're things that aren't very well understood by the medical establishment, and so people don't understand actually how little we know about health and the body, because growing up in the West, you kind of assume that you're led to believe that we know everything, and that, you know, doctors are infallible, and the medical and the psychiatric establishments are infallible, but they're very flawed because they were built in, built on foundations of colonialism.
Oh, definitely.
And so there's a lot of fundamental flaws and, incorrect information and beliefs and ways of dealing with people and bodies that is proliferated throughout the industries. And
exactly.
The systemic critique is really missing too from how people understand disability and understand illness. So that when I talk about I haven't really seen a doctor for this, but I know I have this. Usually people who aren't familiar with chronic illness will be really shocked at that. And if you're marginalized at all, like the way doctors treat you is like, it's such a step down, you know, like medical racism and medical misogyny and transphobia. And even in ableism, it sounds counterintuitive, but medical ableism is, they're really huge problems, and people don't understand how that factors into how disabled people experience, how disabled people access treatment.
I see. And what were your disabilities?
It's kind of a mess. that's kind of another thing, is that it can be even hard to mention it, because like a lot of the times when, like, for chronically ill people, sometimes you don't even know completely what's wrong. It's because either there's just no literature on it, or like doctors just, they don't believe you. Like I've heard so many stories, for example, of, in people with like ovaries, they just won't know they have endometriosis for like decades, because doctors will just be like, oh, like, you know, you're making it up, you're anxious, or it's just a normal.
Or it's because you're fat.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Oh my God. Thank you. My most favorite thing in the world to hear. Or it's like, you know, it's just a normal period. Like you just don't know for that long, even though you're fucking going through like the worst pain you've ever experienced.
I don't think someone should be bleeding a gallon of blood every single day.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like maybe there's something wrong here. Actually, I might want to get that checked out, and maybe that doctor should lose their license. But, the ones that I do know I have, one of the most significant ones is I have cited non-24-hour circadian rhythm disorder. And I say cited specifically because blind people do have a non-24-hour disorder. But it's considered a different disorder because the mechanism behind it is completely different and unrelated. So non-24-hour in blind people is, if as far as I'm aware, fairly well understood, and it's much more common. But sighted non-24-hour, and that's when non-24-hour circadian rhythm disorder is when your sleep schedule is not fixed to the day and nighttime. So you either fall asleep 30 minutes or so, usually earlier every day, or you fall asleep like 30 minutes later every day. So you slowly go around the clock, and no therapy really works to entrain your brain back to the day-night cycle. Like, people with this disorder try everything. They try melatonin, they try light therapy. The vast majority of the time, it doesn't work. So that's probably the most significant one. I just have a lot of chronic pain that I don't really know exactly where it comes from. It might be related to, I also have IBS, so that's fun. Yeah, and I also, you know, I have mental illnesses, but who doesn't?
Okay, that's so, okay, that's like the new saying. It's just like, hey, mental illness, what are you going to do? What can you do?
Yeah, basically.
Oh, that's crazy. I didn't know that was a disorder, like the sleeping thing. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's part of a spectrum of disorders called circadian rhythm disorders, and you can have there's delayed sleep phase, which is basically like you sleep a few hours later than is normal for people. And it's really common, I guess, I don't know about really common, but it tends to be more common in people with ADHD, which I also have. I have autism and ADHD. I guess I forgot to mention that. I tend not to consider them disabilities as much, but I guess that is relevant. But
yeah, we should write everything down on a flashcard, just have them ready at a moment's notice.
I really do. I really feel like that sometimes. I should really get like a fucking list going and all my shit.
Especially if you have to like introduce yourself to a new doctor, like one right after the other.
Oh my gosh. Ugh.
Because my mom is going through dialysis right now, and I actually had to go to the hospital with her. And I watched like a doctor walk in, ask her 5 questions, and then she had to answer the same 5 questions for the next doctor that came in. And then another one came in. And it's just, I can't imagine someone going through that like all the time for their entire lives.
Yeah, like can I just give you a business card?
Like seriously, like or a PowerPoint presentation, I mean shit.
Yeah, right. Jeez.
Warning, cringe. But TikTok made me aware of how many things we don't actually know about the human body and mind, because we just don't know things. Like we just found out how anesthesia like kind of works, but we didn't actually know.
Oh my God. Really?
Well, we were like using it. Yeah. So I don't know. I just think about these things and these things like, what is it called? Rejection dysphoria or something like that.
Oh, rejection sensitive dysphoria.
Yeah. Like my best friend has that, and he like talked to his therapist about it, and his therapist thought he was like crazy or something, because it was like, oh, pseudoscience or something. No, it's like a real thing.
What? You're a therapist.
I know.
Come on.
I know.
It's your job. I have never heard the anesthesia thing before, but it's so funny being someone like me, because like I'll still be like, whoa, what the fuck, really? But like it's, and then I wait a second and I'm like, I'm unsurprised actually, because I find out this kind of shit all the time. I could go on for hours. Oh my goodness.
Oh, I bet. But your experience, you have to like talk about how much pain you're in, and the doctor's just like, I don't know. Is that it?
I mean, yeah, like I've kind of stopped trying to tell doctors about my pain specifically, just because I know it's like, there's nothing physical happening with me. Like I don't have arthritis. So like, there's nothing that I can treat. And so there's nothing they can do. Like that's just kind of how it is. Like, before I found out I had IBS. So I actually only found out I had IBS like a month ago, because, and this is really crazy. Like, last February I got sick, and it was like a weird stomach flu. And to this day, my wife and I wonder if it was COVID. Because there are weird presentations of COVID you can have where it's only gastrointestinal and not coughing.
Huh.
Yeah, it's kind of rare, but like that is like, I've read about that. I don't know how it holds up now, but anyway, weird gastrointestinal illness I had. And then, so it lasted a few days. It was really weird. I remember it being really different from any other stomach flu I've ever had. And then, as I was recovering, I started waking up with like the worst, like stomach pain I've ever felt in my life. Like, it felt like I was worried I had like an ulcer or something, because I recently had my top surgery at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And they give you antibiotics for being post-op. So I wondered if it was something like that maybe. But then like for some reason I discovered that the symptoms got better if I didn't eat dairy. And this was really weird because I'd never had a problem with dairy before. It wasn't lactose intolerance or anything. It was just I had the worst pain ever if I ate dairy. And I started going, I was like, okay, I'll stop drinking, I'll stop having milk in my coffee. And then I would eat a little bit in some chocolate or something. And then I would get the pain and I'd be like, okay, I guess I won't have that anymore. And it just got to the point where I couldn't even have the tiniest bit of butter in a cast iron pan that had been cooked with butter in the last couple weeks or something.
Oh my God.
It was crazy. And so I tried to figure out what the problem was. I went through so many tests, and it started getting worse other than that. There were other trigger foods coming up, and sometimes it just hurt a lot without having trigger foods. I was going crazy. I didn't thank God I didn't have something like stomach cancer or Crohn's disease or something like that, which I did think I had for a little bit. But this is fucking crazy. But my doctor suggested I try a month and a half ago, my doctor was like, you should try the low FODMAP diet. And FODMAPs are they're a kind of, I think a sugar or something that is present in a lot of foods. And they're important for a healthy diet. It's in dairy and beans and stuff like that. And the idea is that FODMAP can help with, because he thought I had IBS. And so FODMAP is you do it for 6 weeks on IBS or roughly that amount of time. It kind of varies. Mm-hmm. And then it helps. It should improve symptoms long term, and nobody really knows why. It's another fucking one of those things where we're like, I don't fucking know, man. But what? my tummy no hurty, so that's good.
Okay.
So they think it's it may be something to do with it just kind of resets your gut biome or something like that. No, as far as I'm aware, nobody knows why it works.
Oh my god, these things should not be up in the air.
I know, dude, oh my gosh, it's crazy. And so I was like, man, if I had to do that, that would suck, but I guess I can just give it a shot. And then, my wife actually was doing some research, because I was kind of torn up about it one night, and so they came upon something called gut-directed hypnotherapy. And it's literally it's just hypnotherapy for IBS. And it has a similar amount of efficacy to the FODMAP diet. And normally an in-person session is thousands of dollars, but there are online courses that are way, way cheaper. So we tried one, and within 3 days, I was able to have all of my trigger foods again, and I have not had nearly the same amount of pain since then because of hypnotherapy.
What the hell?
It's fucking crazy, dude. What? I have no idea. I told my doctor, I was like, hey, man, I tried hypnotherapy, and I feel better now. And he was like, sweet, dude, I'm so happy for you. we don't fucking know anything.
That was fucking insane from start to finish. Holy shit.
That's how I found out I have IBS.
Wow. Holy crap. Is your life always this eventful?
Well, I hope it won't always be.
God damn. Maybe you're going to wake up one day and you're going to start peeling scales off your arm.
Oh my gosh. Please. Well, then I'd be a dragon, so that would be cool, actually.
At least part of you would be a dragon. So true to your true to your persona.
My slow transformation.
Looks like you've landed in the middle of this episode of What's the Fuzz? While you're here, why don't you drop us a follow, especially if you happen to be on Spotify? We're also on Twitter at @whatsthefuzz_, and if you check the show notes of this episode, you'll find donation links to help Black Lives Matter, Stop Asian Hate, and other resources too. Anyway, back to the show!
Since you kind of have, like, quote-unquote invisible disabilities or whatever, what does accessibility mean to you?
I do kind of deal with some of the more literal physical. I do walk with a cane, and I do need to use a wheelchair if we're going to, you know, if we're going to something like a state fair, like if there's a lot of fucking walking around and shit, I do need.
Right.
So like, you know, it's, and if there was better wheelchair accessibility, I would probably use one much more frequently. But, you know, even in a city like Phoenix, like, it's hard. People don't really understand, like, how hard it is to get around in a wheelchair, even if you're in a really metropolitan area. But I guess something else that impacts me a lot is I sometimes have a hard time putting words together or, like, getting my thoughts across right. And this is partly because, so, gosh, I'm going through, like, a fucking laundry list of all of my things. But, like, because... Yeah. I'm dyslexic. I also have a brain injury, which I believe interferes with that a little bit. And also, I'm kind of, it's kind of in remission, I guess you could say, but I'm also schizophrenic, which caused my dyslexia. Fun fact, upon first onset of schizophrenia, 70% of people can develop dyslexia because of that.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. It's, yeah, I don't think I was dyslexic until I had my schizophrenic onset.
That is, Jesus, there's so much shit we don't know, or it's not common knowledge. That was crazy.
Uh-huh, yeah. And so, you know, something that, kind of gets me a lot, I guess, especially because, like, with how hard it is to, get yourself across correctly through text. Like, mm-hmm. I'm really sensitive to, you know, people, like, I guess you could say, like, kind of the worst elements of, like, cringe culture. Like, I'm always, I think people just don't, I feel like people don't have a good enough understanding of people who don't speak very well. And this is something that impacts my wife, too, because my wife is hard of hearing. So... they speak ASL, but they also like speak English. But like it can be really hard for them to talk because they can't hear very well, obviously. And like, they sometimes don't think very well with English. Like they think a lot better with ASL. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's something else I wish people understood about, particularly, I guess, any disability that impacts how you speak or how you communicate is that, you know, sometimes people have a hard time talking or they, you know, they sound maybe a little strange to you because you're not used to it. And that doesn't mean that you can just like cringe at them or something or like make fun of them or assume badly of them for it.
Yeah, it's not like they're not trying or anything. It's just, it can be difficult sometimes. It doesn't mean that you're absolutely less intelligent by any means.
Yeah.
Where does the conversation need to be for things to get better or to change?
Just in the furry fandom or broadly?
I think broadly is a little far beyond us. Let's try the furry fandom. If there was a fur con... and you got picked by the Golden Furry Tale, and you got to go to the FurCon. What kind of things would you expect from them?
Well, I would not become a blueberry, first of all.
That's a good idea.
second of all, I don't know. I'm really looking forward to the, what's it called? Harvest Moon Hellfest?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I'm pretty optimistic. Like, I mean, you know, they're really serious about like keeping attendees safe and not tolerating racists and stuff like that. So that's definitely a very good step in the right direction.
It's always good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then also, you know, things like, you know, keeping cops out of cons, shit like that.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that, actually.
what a wonderful world to have forgotten about cops. I wish I could be there all the time.
Not cops in general, yeah, right. more like cops being at fur cons. Like, that's just a weird visual for me.
Yeah.
Anyways, I just wanted to know, like, right now we're just kind of like trying to get through this phase where like we understand people's differences, but we don't judge them for it, but we also don't pity them. So where does that conversation need to be with accessibility and like understanding people's disabilities?
Well, things like what comes to mind when you ask me that is like feeling like you need to personally go save people, I guess, or be super self-important about helping people. You see this in issues of racism in the form of white saviorism.
Oh, yeah.
I think abled people can have a similar problem where they get super kind of gung-ho about wanting to like help people that like they see as being vulnerable or in need. And, you know, the whole point is giving disabled people more autonomy. So, you know, like we shouldn't like, don't infantilize people. Like that's something I struggle with is I feel infantilized for being autistic in particular, like, just because, you know, sometimes I'm nonverbal or, sometimes I speak with kind of a softer tone of voice. I worry about being infantilized that way by allistics. And, you know, the whole point should be, you should try to see people as just people. Like we're just people.
Yeah. And it's good to let people have their autonomy. Cause if everyone's doing everything for them, it's like, geez, man, I want to live my life. I don't want you to live my life. That kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. Just, you know, like just be aware of like try to be more of a listener.
So giving people options to help themselves
yeah.
would be best.
Yeah, for sure.
Instead of people coming to their aid like Prince Charming.
Yeah, absolutely. Cause I think that shows up in kind of like a psych and medical professional sometimes where there's someone on Tumblr with the handle Heavyweight Heart. And I really love her because she introduced me to Health at Every Size. And it's kind of a general principle of like being fat is not a health problem. Society is a health problem. And also the ways that the medical system pathologizes people unnecessarily for the sake of profit and racism and all these things, that's a health problem. Like, she has talked about before. I remember a post from her where she talked about like she's a cancer patient, and something that is valued in her as a patient is that she understands her own condition and she is able to be like educated on it when she speaks to doctors about her condition. Like it, you know, it saves them the time of having to educate her about like, okay, you have cancer. This is what that looks like. Like she knows what it is and she knows how it affects her and she knows her body. And, you know, it's just that like affording patients autonomy to like acknowledging they know their bodies, they know the conditions they have if they've been educated on it, properly. And like, not being super condescending to them and like thinking of them as like, and that's something you see, especially with like, I think psychiatrists too, is like kind of like seeing mentally ill people as like fascinating or like you just want to get in their heads and like you think of them more as like subjects than as just people who you're trying to help.
Yeah. Like, are you thinking about this guy like Charlie or are you thinking about him like depressed, suicidal smoker with hepatitis C and kidney stones? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Like you got like fucking like the Iron Man, UI and it's like subject number 520. He weight like 120 pounds, you know, depression.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, no, take off the Iron Man helmet. Come on, let's be normal here.
That is a good takeaway, though, to see people for who they are and to listen to them when they're saying something's wrong or that they don't want help or whatever.
Absolutely.
Just people. People! So I wanted to rewind a bit back to your language. Could you tell me a little bit more about it and its origins?
Yes, Smaugach is the Tsimshian language. It literally translates to true or real tongue, the true or real language.
Hmm.
It is technically one of two dialects. It's been called a coastal Tsimshian by anthropologists, and southern Tsimshian is another dialect, but it went extinct in, I believe, earlier this decade. I could be wrong about that, but it was somewhat recent. It went extinct.
Damn.
Yeah. Smaugach is a little bit in danger as well. I don't know the exact number, but it's like I think I saw an estimate that there was about 50 fluent speakers left of Smaugach.
Okay.
It's a little scary. But there's a lot of work right now happening through people of the younger generations to learn it and really try to become fluent in it, because we just don't have a lot of elders left that speak it. There was an elder who passed away last year, and she was like the last fluent speaker in her specific village, and it was really scary. Because it was just another wave of like, oh man, like we're up against time here trying to learn this language. But there's a lot of people are getting on board and trying to help, so it's not a lost cause.
And how many are in your clan?
It's kind of a hard question to answer, because the Tsimshian is the way that the nation is structured is kind of complicated. So traditionally there were 14 villages. There are a couple that have gone extinct. I don't remember exactly how many are left. I think two went extinct. I could be wrong about that, but. So it's split into the villages, and then within the village is split into clans. There's the four clans: Giswitwata, which is killer whale; Ganhada, which is raven; Lachkibu, which is wolf; and Lachskeek, which is eagle. And so each village is, there's like four clan, these four clans in every village, and there are houses that are kind of like little smaller units that are headed by a chief. And the most powerful house, the chief of that house is the leader of the village. And it was, that was our, and is our leadership structure, basically.
So, no estimate on how many then?
There's at least like a few thousand Tsimshians broadly. I can tell you that much.
A few thousand? Damn.
Yeah.
But there's only 50 fluent speakers of your language.
Yeah, I mean, that's colonization for you. We didn't lose as many people statistically as some other, at least that's the impression I've gotten. As some other neighboring nations, but you know, it was West Coast nations got colonized much later than the ones in the plains in the east, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Our Christianity was brought to Tsimshian in the 1830s, 40s. I could be wrong, but in mid 1800s. It was only brought to us at that point. So, what was I trying to say? Oh yeah. So like, you know, after that point, like, our traditional practices started being demonized, and, It was really forced on us. Like, you can't speak the language, you can't potlatch, you know, you can't do this or that. And that was so ingrained in the older generations that the traditions just weren't passed on.
So they started dying off.
Damn. Yeah, exactly. There were some people who did their best, but you know, it's yeah, I guess that's all I have to say about that.
Only so much can be done, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That is how genocide works, after all.
Yeah, I mean, fuck, dude.
But I'm glad to hear that there's been a little bit of a resurgence and an effort to preserve the language, because it sounds really cool. Did you have any, like, traditions that you personally wanted to pass on someday?
Well, I definitely do. My wife and I do plan to have a kid at least someday. And I would love to be able to. That's a huge motivator for me learning the language as well, is I want to be able to teach my kid or kids, the language as well. Like I want to be able to speak to them in Smalgiach and like have them think in Smalgiach as much as they do English, which is a tall order considering there's not a lot of fluent speakers right now. But
well, hell, someday they will be.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the idea.
So besides the language, do you have anything like fishing or something?
I was not really raised, because my mom was adopted out, so I wasn't really raised. I had to reconnect with a lot of the culture as I got older. But yeah, I mean, I would love to be able to teach my kid as much of the culture that I am familiar with and that we are able to practice, for sure. I don't know if there's anything else specifically I could think of, just teaching them the history and, you know, like you are, because, you know, I am a woman, so we are matrilineal. We pass on our clan and everything through the matrilineal line. So I would pass that on to my child. And so, you know, like you are Gizbitwada and you're Simshian. Yeah, it would just be really cool to have my kid be really familiar with that, where I had to reconnect with that as an adult.
What was that reconnection like, that journey for you? Like, what kicked it off?
Sorry, I had to readjust. My legs hurt. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
That's okay.
It was a little difficult because the circumstances of my mom's adoption were a little wild. I'll just say it. It's kind of a crazy story. My mom, she and her siblings were abandoned in a hotel when they were children.
What the fuck?
It's a little crazy. So as you can guess, it was hard to get like information about my family and all that. So, I had to, there wasn't a lot of information about like my grandmother and stuff like that. So I had to go through, talk directly to, people from Simshian and neighboring nations through like online through the internet, and try to work out like who my family was, but you know, up until that point, I mean, you know, it was painful, like not really knowing a lot about my heritage, but now that I do know, it's been very, very healing, and I'm very grateful to have been able to find that out, because the avenue to do it through, you know, like looking at like adoption papers and stuff like that just wasn't really an option.
I see. So it's kind of like hunting down your own history then.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, what was the most interesting piece of knowledge that you happened upon during that journey?
I was honestly just, I was very happy to find out my clan and my to have a heritage, like a lineage that I inherited, because, you know, if you're a father, you don't pass down your clan or anything to your children. I was very grateful that I was just able to, like, I did have a place I was able to inherit. And, you know, because the way that people deal with that nowadays is because, you know, some people, like, they don't have a Tsimshian mother, but they have a Tsimshian father, so that, you know, they're Tsimshian, but, like, they don't get, like, a clan, because right. That's just how it works. So, but the way that people deal with that now is, like, they get adopted by usually, like, an auntie or someone else like that. But, you know, that's, like, it's complicated, and it was really cool to find, like, wow, like it was like when I found out that I do have a clan, I was like, it was really cool, like, knowing that I had a place.
You had somewhere you belonged to.
Yeah, absolutely.
You weren't just some random person just thrown out there.
Yeah.
So I think before you mentioned you're, like, Two-Spirit?
Yes.
How would you describe Two-Spirit?
For me, it's, you know, I kind of feel, in terms of my gender, I feel a little bit stuck because, you know, I don't, you know, like, the colonial terms don't really describe my gender adequately. So I'm stuck between two places on, in that end. And I'm also, you know, I am a non-binary lesbian, and I present very masculinely, and it's hard because, like, you know, I identify as a woman, but I also, I sport a beard because if I don't, I get very dysphoric, but that's how I experience being a woman. And it's really weird and alienating to go out in real life and people will, you know, will read me as a man. And it's, you know, I taking testosterone. So, like, I knew going into it, like, yeah, okay, people are going to start seeing me as a man now. And it's better than being dysphoric in the sense that, like, you know, if people read me as a cis woman, I get dysphoric, like, very dysphoric. But being read as a cis man is really weird too. Not as painful, but it's still, it's a different kind of pain in that it's like, I can't win. Like, people won't really see me for who I actually am just because of colonial gender standards.
Hmm. That's interesting. Do you know if Two-Spirit people played any interesting or significant roles in your clan or village or something?
I don't know specifically. I haven't really had the opportunity to ask a lot, I suppose. I've been so focused on learning language mostly, but...
Aw, dang.
Yeah. There are, obviously, because I introduced, when I said in my introduction, notsnu emiutanu, that means I am gay and I am a masculine woman. So there was a term for homosexuality. There is a term for homosexuality, I should say. And there is at least, I don't know if, like, a miuta, which is, it means kind of like masculine woman, tomboy. I don't know if that corresponds to, like, a specific gender category as much as it does just describe a woman who is masculine, you know, the same way we use tomboy in English. But, like, we also, you know, because there was so much loss of, like, the, like, culture and language was not practiced as much in the last couple generations because of colonization. Not everybody knows everything about what pre-colonial life was like. So I actually don't even know if anyone knows really if that was the case.
Well, you're still finding out stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, maybe someone will know, or it's just out there and I have to find it, you know, like maybe there's an elder who remembers or something, but
hell yeah.
Yeah. Try to keep my hopes up.
Yeah. I mean, why not? Right. But yeah. I think that's really interesting to be kind of wedged between and have this thing where it's like, I'm one thing, but also this other thing, but
yeah,
it's strange, but it's also kind of cool.
Yeah.
Harkening back to that, the amalgamation of like your background and your persona and everything. It's just very, it's very you.
Thank you. Now you got it.
So how did you get started with art?
I have been drawing like as long as I remember. I distinctly remember when I was like a toddler. I guess I mean maybe toddler's a little young, but when I was like 5 to 6, I started like drawing Pokemon from like how to draw Pokemon books. Like I would try to draw Pikachu and stuff like that, and I just kind of never stopped. I've been drawing like almost constantly since then, like just like doodles at least and stuff like that.
Damn, that's quite the legacy.
Like, it's just kind of something I've always done. Like, I don't, like, people, like, so I sometimes see other artists get asked, like, why do you draw? Like, why did you start drawing? And I'm always like, I don't know, man. Like, I came out the pussy drawing. I don't know what to say. Like, I breathe, I draw. It's what I do, man.
It's like a fish to water.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, with the color theory and stuff, you just, like, look at it and you know? Or, like, how does that work?
Pretty much. I never took formal art courses, and...
What?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
You're kidding me. You didn't even take high school art class?
Well, okay, yes. I wasn't high school art, but I mean, I never went to like art like college. I dropped out of high school. Actually, I didn't go to college or anything. So I've just kind of been vibing drawing art my whole life. So yeah. I look at colors and I know.
Damn, some people get all the cool abilities. I swear. Tell me about your favorite piece and what makes it your favorite.
I guess the form line piece I drew of my fursona, which is my Discord icon and it's my Twitter icon, is probably one of the ones that comes to mind, because it's I did not grow up drawing form line. It's something I've been learning over the last couple years, and it feels really good to like to get it right, because it's a really hard art form, and people who learn it, like, they spend their whole lives learning it. Traditionally you would be apprenticed, I believe, by someone who was like very, very well practiced with it. It was really cool to like draw, to finally get to a point where I was like maybe I can try drawing like a petition formula, and I think that'd be cool. And then I did it and I thought it turned out all right, and I was like, whoa, this is so cool. Like, damn. it's like my fursona, but like it's in like it's me, but like it's in form line. That's cool.
That is cool. So you've like strapped yourself into like this lifelong art style?
Yeah, I mean, something that there's a very famous Tsimshian artist by the name of David R. Boxley, and something he says a lot is you have to be a lifetime student. And that's something I try to remember. I think that's very pertinent.
You never stop learning.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the most important thing you've learned since you started drawing?
Honestly, just learning to not really to take ideas and criticism like selectively. Like, people will a lot of like art tips and stuff like that that you see, like don't shade with black and stuff like that, are very like, they're very industry oriented. So it's like, you know, if you're trying to get a job like at like an in-house job, like being like a concept artist or something like that, tips like that make sense because it's like, well, there's an industry standard and you're not really drawing for yourself. You're drawing for like a studio, for a corporation. But when it comes to just doing art, I mean, it's like, just like follow what you want to do. Like you should only improve if you seem, or, well, let me rephrase that. You should only like, work criticism into your art if you feel like it's like relevant to what you want to achieve. And if you think that it can actually improve on what you want to do, like if somebody is coming at you, like, you know, like don't shade with this color, like it's, and you're like, but you like really want to, you really think it can work, like just fuck it, like whatever.
Hey, well said. So are you familiar with the land back movement?
No, I'm just kidding. Yes, I am. Obviously.
Yeah, I guess gotta make sure. So how does it relate to you and your struggles?
Obviously, being Indigenous, decolonization is something that it's, I try to keep it at the forefront of my thoughts all the time. Like it's a mindset. Like I'm constantly like looking for ways that, things that might be embedded in me that are more reactionary or colonized ways of thinking. Land back isn't just about the land, it's about everything. It's about like, it's about the way that we see people and relation, that like our relationships to each other and including the land, but also like, you know, how we govern ourselves. Like, so that's something I try to take with me everywhere. Just in the way I see the world and the way that I learn and I interact with people and that I try to, heal myself from just everything that we go through in the day to day.
Damn, I like that answer. It really makes you think. So how comfortable are you then as identifying as Indigenous in general? Or do you prefer to something else?
I use a lot of terms, Indigenous, Native, just Tsimshian. Sometimes I'll use, even though like I wasn't born and raised in Alaska, sometimes when I'm talking to Americans, I'll use Alaskan Native because that's like, it's like the closest thing they understand. it's like, oh yeah, okay, so you're from up there. Not, because if I just say Native, then they might assume that I'm from like the lower 48, which is not true.
So you're more like the colder climate kind of.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. Tsimshian, I guess I should have clarified. Tsimshian is our territories are on kind of the Skeena River, which is northern BC and southeast Alaska.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
I would die. Oh no. The cold would kill me.
I love it, man.
Oh no. Oh geez. Are you the kind of person to roll around in the snow?
Well, maybe not like that. I don't love the cold that much.
Okay. I'm just saying. Usually when people say that, they just jump into a pile of snow and just like, ah. Okay. But usually people say Indigenous because if you were like from here, Native Americans kind of like something liberals came up with to feel better about themselves for the centuries of genocide.
Yeah, it really, it depends. Like, I have friends who call themselves like American Indians, and they're very, like they prefer sometimes to be called Indians, at least by other natives.
Yeah.
It really depends on like your family and like if you're, you know, where you're from exactly.
It's like a multi-layered thing. Doesn't always have a easy solution, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
And how do you feel the indigenous folks are perceived in the fandom and in general?
Well, it seems like it's getting better. But it definitely, it's very frustrating because it feels like, for the most part, they just kind of see, you know, non-native furries, particularly white ones, are just all about, like, they try to take the aesthetic, like, they just see us as objects, like, they just want to objectify our cultures, like, it's not very often, I don't see... people trying to, for example, like, just like draw form line and like try to make a market off that, thankfully. Right. But I have seen a couple of people who they're just like, I guess I don't want to give too many details because I don't want to platform them or anything by any means. They're not very active anymore anyway, so it's whatever. But I found like a profile of someone who is not native, who just drew like tribal quote unquote and like form line quote unquote art. They drew what they thought was form line because they just kind of look at like the Google, like the, they just look up Google images and are like, oh, I guess I can draw that, whatever. And so they try to mimic it, but it's not form line because it's a very specific, it's a system. Like, so you know, like, I don't see that very much, but, like, it's happened a couple of times, and it's really frustrating, because, like, it's only thanks to the efforts of, like, a few very skilled and prolific formline artists of the older generations that we even have that tradition passed on as intact as it is, because, you know, it could have been lost, too, or been as little practiced as, for example, small gyach was like a generation ago. And then for like white furries to just see it and be like, oh yeah, I can draw that, whatever. And so then they put it up on Redbubble or some shit and they just do this half-assed thing that's like clearly not, they advertise it as formline, but it's not. It drives me crazy.
That sounds absolutely maddening. Especially when it's supposed to be something you commit your life to. Like, come on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like this, like formline is, it's something that we use to represent, like not just, you know, it's a visual language. Like it also represents, it can be used for abstract designs. And in pre-colonial times, we also, you know, we did also just sell like formline art and other, and like all sorts of art. And so like we traded it and sold it. Like it's not exclusively like a sacred art form or something like that, but it represents our crests and our stories and our spirituality, our way, our relations. Like and it takes a long fucking time to learn and get 100%. Well, as close to 100% as you can ever get down. So yeah, it's really frustrating just because it's highly stylized. And it doesn't use, you know, like it's not very complex in its colors that white people will just be like, oh, that's easy. And then they fucking try to draw it and then it sucks shit because it's not.
What aspect of your culture are you most proud of?
I mean, the art is a huge part of it for sure. I really feel like that me being compelled to draw as much and as early as I did is a product of the fact that I am Tsimshian. Like I really think that that's like a kind of a spiritual gift that
interesting.
Yeah. It's, I think that that was me coming back to like the ancestral knowledge, you know? And so that definitely constitutes a lot of my connection and my pride. But it also goes beyond just the art. Like, I mean, there's there's the potlatching and the which the relationships we have with each other and the language and the ceremonies. Like,
what is potlatching?
Potlatching is it's part of our legal system. Basically, it wasn't a way to like you gather people and then you like the people who were hosting the potlatch give it. I'm trying to get this as right as I can. They provide food and they give gifts and stuff like that. And it's basically like a way to distribute things and to bring things into the public eye. So like that's when you. Like if you are passing a name on to someone, if you're giving somebody a name, then you do it with a potlatch. It's a way to conduct legal and spiritual matters. And so you give names and you might bring out like new like cultural property and like present it. As far as I'm aware, basically, yeah.
So did COVID affect your area at all?
Yes. Oh, gosh. Maricopa County was like, it was the worst place in the world for COVID transmission a few weeks ago.
Really?
Yes.
God damn.
It was very, very bad. I honestly don't keep up as much because I just kind of stay inside and I tend to kind of not really look stuff up because it just doesn't really cross my mind. But mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, like it's bad. There's I guess I don't know as much about like the hospital vacancies and stuff like that because sometimes I'll hear like California there's zero beds and everything's crazy and I'm like. That sucks. That sounds so bad.
I know. It just makes you paralyzed in fear. Like, oh shit.
Yeah.
The world really is ending.
Yeah. I mean, like I don't really keep up as much locally cause it just doesn't really reach my ears for whatever reason. So I don't know exactly the exacts, but it would not surprise me at all to know. Cause I mean, I guess like, in terms of the native communities that are around here, the Navajo Rez was doing pretty poorly with COVID
mm-hmm.
for a long time. I saw, there was like a lot of, fundraisers and stuff going around, cause they were really, really struggling. And, I haven't checked in on that lately. I think they're getting vaccines and stuff. Cause there's a lot of, reservations were one of the priorities for COVID vaccines, thankfully. So there have been vaccines going around.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what the picture is like right now, but yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if things hit really badly too in the city because, you know, Phoenix has a lot of people of color and a lot of, class segregation. So it wouldn't surprise me.
Indeed. I hope things can start getting better for real.
Me too.
So how effective would you say the response was to COVID?
In my area?
Yeah, like how would you rate it if you had to give it a grade?
Negative 10.
Jesus, okay, damn.
I mean, yeah, like I mean nothing shut down. Like there were some restaurant shutdowns. Non-essential business shutdowns at the beginning. I really don't remember very well. I didn't keep up very much. But yeah, I mean, businesses have been open this whole time, basically.
I can't believe that shit. That's crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, walking around, like, I did not see. I guess now, like, that there was a there's like businesses that have mask mandates and stuff. So I have been seeing like, and I think there was some. Gosh, I don't remember. Like, the governor, or the mayor of Phoenix, or something, put on a mask mandate. I think for. Some period of time. So I did see the mask wearing go up and it was much better. But at the beginning of the pandemic, it was really bad. I didn't see probably half of people wearing masks.
God, I can't imagine that shit. It's so rough.
It was pretty bad. Yeah, Phoenix is wild.
How do you think Indigenous peoples and other POC fit into the BLM movement?
Well, I mean, as allies, for sure. Like, Black and Native people are both victims of U.S. colonization. And so just the solidarity is really, really important. Like showing up and making sure to include issues, like Black issues in our conversations and when we think about decolonization. I believe the Chickasaw freedmen are trying to get recognition right now because their tribe, and this is a problem with certain, like the Cherokee Nation the other day, I think, finally voted, and it's been kind of on and off with them. I don't know if this was always the case. I think it wasn't for a little bit, and then it was. I don't remember. There was some nation like that, but just the other day, they finally removed the blood necessity from their citizenship. So for all that time, descendants of freedmen were not able to become Cherokee citizens because they didn't have Cherokee blood, but they're Cherokee because they were fucking enslaved.
Yep.
So they walked the Trail of Tears, guys. So yeah, like the other day, finally they struck that from the Constitution, and I believe there's freedmen of other tribes, the Chickasaw freedmen, I think, that are the ones that come to mind, are still trying to get recognition. So you know, that's just one of the many ways that we have to really be active about including Black issues when we speak about decolonization.
Oh, definitely. Black people and Native people have been in it from the beginning, for real.
Yeah.
But certain forces tried to pit us against each other. We got to move past that. We have to make amends. We got to come together.
The hell yeah.
Yeah, seriously, because the last thing you want to do is let them win. I mean, come on.
Yeah, as my community, we have a saying, "Sakait kum got," and that means all of one heart, and it's basically our term meaning like solidarity.
Oh, that's cool as hell. I like that.
Yeah.
What are some cool BIPOC furs out there doing cool shit that you want to shout out?
I got to shout out Tanya Song. She's my friend, and she's been speaking about Native issues in the fur fandom for a long time, doing mm-hmm. so much work. I have a lot of respect for Wolf's art as well, as we mentioned earlier. Yeah, I mean, just like, gosh, I have a lot of like, I have a lot of different mutuals I have that. Whose art I really, really respect. I wish I could go down like a list, but it would take me like half an hour.
Flashcards. You got to get those flashcards ready. I'm telling you.
My disability flashcards, my Twitter mutual flashcards. I got a lot to work on.
All right. Last question for you. What is your favorite thing about being a furry?
Just getting to be whatever the fuck animal I want, I guess. I can literally draw myself as a fucking weird orca dragon with stripes and antlers, and people will just be like, oh, hell yeah, man, that's cool. All right, you're that now, and we respect that. And I'm like, nice.
All right, that just about does it for this episode. Thank you again, sir, for coming on the show and chatting with me.
Hell yeah.
You've got the spotlight to promote anything you like. Go for it.
Oh, goodness. Intuition for having me. Thank you. I have a portfolio at, it's serber.us, but the first E is a hyphen. That's my portfolio. You can find, I have a webcomic. It's called Catlamp, and, sometimes I open commissions. You can always keep an eye out for that. I also shout them out on Twitter. In terms of other things I would shout out, I guess just look up whose land you live on. Support them. Just support Native people. Support the people local in your area who are struggling. Look up activist groups. Read about the history of the places that we live on and try to incorporate that into your life. And also remember, we don't fucking know anything about the body and the mind. So just, you know, if you struggle with going to the doctor because doctors don't fucking believe you or they don't understand you. I feel that. Yeah, I guess that's it.
Be sure to follow the show at whatsthefuzz_ on Twitter and follow Serb at C_Burris. Thanks everybody out there for watching or listening or whatever. See you next time. Bye-bye.